Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I am your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we are going to be speaking on the ECOWAS, troubled ECOWAS region. Today I'm joined by a very important guest, Brigadier General Sally Bala, a retired military officer of the Nigerian Armed Force. He's currently the Chief Executive Officer of White Inc. Consort. White Inc. Consort is a private defense and security research, strategic communications and training consultancy based in Abuja, Lagos. He's also the founder of the White Inc. Institute for Strategy, Education and Research, also based in Abuja, Lagos. General Bala is also a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. General, clearly you've had a very long, illustrious career and experience. I'm happy and blessed to have you join us today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nwapa.
Yeah, so I'll just start off with the key question. So on September 16, 2023, we have three members of the ECOWAS region, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, signed a new mutual defense pact named the Alliance of Sahel States. So effectively withdrawing their membership from the ECOWAS bloc. What implication does this have for the ECOWAS region?
Thank you very much. To make a quick correction, there is always the assumption that that there are two countries within this geopolitical space, you know, Nigeria and Lagos. Probably this is why, Dr. Nwakwa, you fell to the default of saying my institute and my consultancy are established in Abuja, Lagos. My institutes are located in Abuja, Nigeria. But that's on a lighter mood, though. Yes, it's a long story if it would have been, you know, in this program to give backgrounds on the decision of the Sahelian states that are ruled by military governments. Their decision to withdraw from ECOWAS. But as simple as direct as it is a matter of national survival, because they were kicked out by ECOWAS, so to speak, in principle, and they remain a pariah. So they needed to come together and make a decision to carry on the lives of their states. And this is what we have seen. And what implications there are, if you have read the statement by ECOWAS on the recant they've made of the sanctions and all the military threats against particularly Niger and in a wholesome level, the sanctions against the states, it's only simply because ECOWAS realized that ECOWAS leaders realize that the foreign aid and also the foreign control which they enjoy and which protects them will be affected in quantums by the withdrawal of Niger and the Sahelian states. It was clear that there was enormous counterterrorism funding that comes from international partners, which by law was passed by the European Union as a bloc support to ECOWAS, by which if a segment of ECOWAS actually breaks away, this illusion, it's actually an illusion of funding, will cease from coming to ECOWAS. I call it an illusion of funding because we know very well that there is a declaration, you know, by us citizens and even our leaders, we have a culture of selective amnesia. We fully know that the European Union has actually withdrawn the African Peace Fund in substantially and has converted it to support the Ukrainian war. So in principle, it is one or nothing. But I also believe that the presiding ECOWAS leaders, so to speak, have really understood that all these sanctions they have placed and the pariah state they have declared on this Sahelian states has actually generated an opportunity for those states to be able to look inwards to build certain strengths that they have. And they fully realize that they can really actually go it alone. Sanctions, as we have seen across geopolitical history, is that what it does, it only affirms the position of whoever we declare as pariah. And this is what we have seen going on with these Sahelian states. So, and with the glory of the outlet that our venerable elder General Yakubu Ngawan had given to the ECOWAS leaders, they had to quickly latch on that in order to reverse and backstep and actually lick their own vomit, excuse my language, by recalling these states back into ECOWAS. This is going up to a week. None of the states has even made any comments in response to the statement issued by the chairman of ECOWAS. We have learned, from one of my sources, in spite of the opening of the Nigerian-Niger borders, I am told firsthand that the Nigerian forces have refused for supplies to get into Niger. That speaks a lot. I probably will stop a bit here so that you can come in with follow-ups.
Yeah, General, you've said so many things that link into several of the questions I want to ask. So I'm just going to go straight to the key one to look at the international dimension of it. So we've seen, you've mentioned the EU, and then again, I look at it, the role of the EU and how ECOWAS region or the ECOWAS has been positioned to be, how am I going to put it, not upfront, but to help international organizations, basically Western powers, deal with insecurities in those regions. So, and then we've seen in recent times, Russian, that these alliances of side, these Niger countries are Niger, Burkina Faso, Mali have been supported by Russia. So do we see, how do you speak on the geopolitical competition or rivalry that presents or portends in terms of the Western and then the Russia backing these countries under military rule?
We must first understand that we are independent sovereign states, and we have every right to associate and deal with any political entity that we so deem at our own interests. To say Russia and China are new partners to African countries is failed propaganda. I repeat, to say Russia, China and the targeted countries which the West is speaking to are new partners to us. It's sheer propaganda. Because even for those of us who have had long colonial associations with the West, especially for countries like the UK and the France, and find out that militarily, the most support and equipment that you can identify among those countries ever since the 60s have been Russian equipment. MiG helicopters, MI-15, MI-16, MI-38 helicopters, AK-47s for common. These are the kinds of equipment ever since that sub-Saharan African countries are able to afford and able to maintain. And we have been training with the Russians for so long. So to prime that, Dr. Nwapa, with all your PhDs, because you are seen along with a Russian, then the Russian is manipulating you. And you do not have a sense of self and a patriotic sense. But I have overflogged this statement that I make, that when your house is on fire, what you require is water to quench the fire, not the quality of the water or conditions that the water must be purified, it must have fire hydrant in it, and so on and so forth. So when sanctions and conditions are placed with on us, where we have threats of very high military nature, and we need forces and equipment to fight these threats, and we are told issues like weapons will be given to us and we will use them on our citizens, human rights issues are involved, and so on and so forth, and we sit down and we watch our troops slaughtered by terrorists, we see our citizens slaughtered by terrorists, and we can do nothing because we don't have democratic compliance, we do not have human rights compliance. So these are the issues. So I always get interested when people say Russia is making inroads into Africa. We have been in association with Russia for over 60 years. For over 60 years. With due respect, we could not prosecute the unity war of Nigeria in the 60s into the 70s without the support of the Russians. That couldn't have been achieved. Absolutely. Because the unity of this country is primed upon what support we were able to prosecute with T-55s, with AK-47s, and the MiG aircraft that we had. So I do not want to belabor the point that that Russia is just making inroads, including China. And what more, to add upon again in an argument I was having just before I started this conversation, I give you an example. If you are buying a mine-resistant anti-personnel armor fighting vehicle from the West, minimum for one unit is $1 million. That is without radios and armament. And averagely for a battalion, you will need up to 360 of those vehicles for one battalion. How can our economy be able to sustain this? While when you go to the West, or when you go to Russia and you go to China, you can get this equipment for one quarter the price. You may have arguments about quality, but let us go back to my statement about about when your house is on fire. What you need are this equipment to be able to prosecute. This conflict that you have before you, again, not to belabor this point, we are a sovereign nation. If you go to the United States, the Nigerian and the African diaspora is actually driving those nations, including people like you in the West. So we are not blind and lily-livered people gone back to those pre-colonial days where we were considered as primitive natives. We are highly educated, sophisticated people who also have a sense of our own destiny.
I guess I agree with you 100%. And I guess my question, maybe I didn't communicate it well, was not whether African nations have agency of choice, because I understand even during the Cold War, many African countries were non-aligned. But I guess my question, what we've seen, and rightly so, in these places, we've seen a growing anti-Western sentiment. And I had the first secretary of the United States embassy here in London come to one of the episodes, and she admitted clearly, and I had another American come as well. They admitted that, you know, the West-term policies in Africa has failed. You know, they also admitted some of the hypocrisy or the double standard, and you know that was quite illuminating to hear. So, but my question is not so much whether Russia has been active or China has been active. The question is, if you look at the Cold War politics, where the African nations were able to leverage or play those two sides. So they say when two elephants fight, it's the grass that suffer. So I'm just saying, the geopolitical competition and this rivalry, how does Africa nation, how does it play out to our benefit or disadvantage? So how does it play out?
Probably my answer is intrinsic in the comments I have made before this question. Before I joined this podcast, I had had an argument, a long steaming argument with a friend of mine, actually about what the problem we have. Is it a problem of physical threats we are seeing, or an outcome of social malaise, or simply political irresponsibility of leadership? Politics is at the head driver of any sovereignty, because it is out of politics you draw leaders who lead the various sectors, including professional sectors like military, medicine, law, and all the very noble professions, academia and all. And as long as we do not get our politics correctly, this sexed up concept of democracy, in spite of its fine principles that is being sold and celebrated, we can never get it right. So establishing this is the fact that if we have correct, appropriate political leadership, all these threats that we have that are spiraling, for which we have winked ourselves actually to believe that these threats must in perpetuity be countered with a military solution, which is expensive, which is non-enduring, which is non-sustainable. But that if we are able to get our politics right and drive our nations based on political appropriateness, most of these social issues that rise and get aggravated into insurgencies, for which we hardly in the conversation of peace and conflict address issues as insurgencies, which are conflicts arousing from exclusion, both in political, social, and economic spheres, for which we rather voice as terrorism. Terrorism in the meaning that it is an uprising, violence based on people who just want to kill and maim people for no reason. So for as long as we do not, with all the intellectual wealth that we as Africans have, and factor our ability to really serve the purpose of our people, we will never have the peace that is required to be sustained through political engineering, but rather we will always rely on military force and the force of law enforcement, which laws are indeed even couched to further exclude and repress our people. If we are able to achieve this, the issue of whether the West or the East are things of international political reality that we can just manage without them being such an albatross on us. I am always quick to give the example of Rwanda, where there is strong, long, and visionary leadership. And you don't see clashes between the two civilizations in this young and growing country because they have a purposeful leadership that is patriotic and understands where the nation is supposed to go.
I agree with you, and I think again you've clearly said that the I think it was someone else that I interviewed. You might know her, Dr. Fatima Akilu, that was saying that it's cheaper to deal with governance than achieving peace through force. And you've rightly mentioned citing the example of the mine resistant equipment that probably will cost about $1 million for one, and then you need over 360. Yes. And then providing governance might definitely cost lesser than that.
Absolutely.
And cost lesser than that. But we've done seen again, and I'm quite happy that, you know, coming from a former military officer, this is also very interesting to see that the solution is not always military force. But then again, we're looking at across Africa, and then if I pick Nigeria as a case study, now, we've seen with the Niger Delta, we've seen with IPOB, we've seen with the IMN, where, in my opinion, these groups have been mislabeled as a terrorist organization that disincentivizes the government or the authorities from dealing with the root causes of these issues, or where we've seen secessionist tendencies. So, but is this just solely about leadership? Are there no other, are we not seeing issues of justice, lack of justice in these cases as well? Is it just having a leader? Are we also looking at the structure of the foundation of these countries? Mostly in Africa, looking at our colonial past, looking at, for instance, you look at Nigeria, for instance, and look at those primordial drives, like, you know, the ethnicity, the religion, you know, people driven along those lines. Is it leadership that is going to fix this? Or do we need to really sit down and look at all these? Is it more complex than that? Or is it just as simply as having a good leadership, as you've rightly mentioned?
It is as simple as having good leadership, Nwakwa. The most successful countries in the world are the most diverse. Are the most diverse countries: China, India, United States of America, the UK. Today in the UK, if I get it correct, if you are a US citizen, if you are a UK citizen or a resident, I don't think Sunil is an original Briton. He's an Indian with a clear lineage to India. His wife only last week, there was pictures of her and her and her billionaire father sitting and enjoying ice cream. Mm. The UK is a component of the Welsh, of the Irish, of the British, of which their economy is driven today by the diaspora.
Mm.
So it's all a question of sentiment. Back to my easy example. If you go back 30 years back, if you go 30 years back and you go to a nation called Rwanda, it is a composition of a people that are called Hutus and Tutsis.
Tutsis. Mm.
Today, if you meet an average Rwandan on the street and you ask him, are you Hutu or Tutsi? I swear to you, go on the streets of London and try this. And each one you will meet will tell you with a smile, I am Rwandese.
Rwanda. Mm.
And I speak Kirwanda.
Mm.
And it took one person to be able to achieve that.
Mm.
The US Marines have a mantra that the strongest steel is made from the hottest furnace.
Mm.
You don't build a nation by kissing people. You build a nation on a structure that ensures that people are bound together, that people are riveted together.
Mm.
When we continue to play the sentiments of 1914 or whatever it is as Nigerians, and that we were forced to come together, we are a people over this spread of beautiful land that have been interacting in history over the years.
Before the colonial people, yeah. Before
the white pre-colonial people. Nigeria has been in existence. Mm. The Edos claim that they are that they parented the Yoruba nation. Today it has been forced upon us that we are not Fulanis, we are not Hausas, we are Hausa Fulani.
Mm.
The Kanuris and the Shua. So if you want to really sit down to a national argument that throws up these conflicts, for how long can you go?
Mm.
The President Jonathan tried it out and convoked the national conference, for which the 6 months affair took 2 months of the various constituents arguing about their accommodation, their vehicles, and so on and so forth. So, my brother, the problem of Africa, like it is the problem with most polities across the world, is a matter of elitism. A matter of representation, that I want to make representation for myself, and I claim responsibility for my mandate from my people. Without mentioning names, all the crooks that have run across and are living in safe heavens that you know, they don't have one investment in the Niger Delta or in the Southwest or in the Southeast or in Northern Nigeria. Northern Nigeria, that by every indices of development, that is considered the lowest in Nigeria. With all the billionaires and the millionaires that we have, who make claims of representation of our people. I don't want to divert and sound political, but the point is this, that for how long can a nation be intimidated by force, and for every effort that is being made to engage people to conversations, we see that belligerence now becomes the currency for engagement. It doesn't work so. I was privileged as a young colonel to be secretary of the committee that developed the amnesty program during President Yar'Adua's effort. Now, I ask you, with all the investment going into the development of the Niger Delta. I don't mind if I'm controversial, and the amnesty program. How long is this going on, and how sustainable it is?
These really are
the questions. And the military by themselves, if you listen to the military, even the young, with all respect, even the young General Chris Gwabin Musa, who is doing a fantastic job, has said it, that the military is not the solution, but the force of the military is one of the instruments of national power that is applied in order to bring a convenient and comfortable setting for the political solution, for the most enduring political, economic, and social solution to be applied. So the use of the military can never be removed.
If I start from there and bring it back to ECOWAS and see what Chris Musa have said, and also, you know, our argument about the military force cannot bring about a solution, that's a given fact. If I bring it back to ECOWAS and look at the coup in Guinea, and some of the issues that have occurred is, you know, these countries that like Niger, Mali set a timetable to return to democratic government, and then, you know, the goalpost is being moved forward every time. So, and then if we look at the history of military coups in the continent, in the region as well, it's can we say the military has effectively been able to facilitate such smooth change and development? Because the military itself has not been able, like Riley said, been able to pioneer or effect that development. So if you look at in the ECOWAS states, these countries that are under this junta government, that's what I'm saying. And we've seen the popular sentiment among the popular support, which is rightly so. But are we going to see it leading to a greater change for the people? Or is it going to be, like you rightly said, and I've been arguing, is it going to also be captured by the elites? Because there are elites in the military, there are elites in the. Is it going to also be captured by the elites as well? Are the people going to benefit from this?
Definitely. It is not a question that one has a straight answer. You know, I have, in my 30 years of military service, I have never held or participated in any political appointment. I have been privileged to be a soldier throughout those 30 years. Out of the less than 5% that on national call had to participate in the political leadership of Nigeria. Nigeria, for example, witnessed quite some appreciable level of development during the military, which can never be denied the military. As much as the military is an aberration, and I believe strongly by the kinds of very educated and sophisticated military generals that we have now, a coup will never happen in Nigeria. But in those other countries where you have political leaders voted into power, not governing at all, extending tenures, perpetuating themselves in office, neglecting resourcing of sectors to deal with existential threats. Such countries, for no doubt, will have their citizens push their military, because it is only by force that such political leadership can be removed, proven by the fact that they rig elections, they suspend elections, they even do exactly like the military do, they suspend elections. and constitutions. We are just in the throes of what is going on with Macky Sall in Senegal. So where politics becomes the matter and the focus of state, and not as a facilitator of peace, security, and development for a people. The rise of grudges and grievances, which escalates into insurgencies, for which the military always bear the brunt. We will continue to see such, and development will really suffer. Most of these countries, when you visit them, only the capital and for purpose where the elites and where the and where the official buildings are the most developed. Maybe the road from the airport to the presidential palace. When you speak about development in those countries that are taken over by militaries, especially you, if you recall even the example for Nigeria, those coupists of 1966 were those who came back from courses in America, in the UK, and actually saw how political leaders are driving and developing their countries, and how in their own case, political leadership is supplanting development. So these are the realities that are with us. Elite capture, corruption and elite capture is a reality, not just in Nigeria, but across the world. But one thing that goes is the rule of law, is the strength of institutions. That's why President Donald Trump can be arrested, can be subpoenaed and tried before a court of law. So unless, as elites, we are able to rise to our responsibilities, which we, from which privilege we are enjoying, our nations will continue to remain underdeveloped, and grudges and grievances from amongst the people will continue to rise to such kind of violent threats that we are experiencing, which is also drawing back our development.
Like Riley said, the institutions matters. And the ECOWAS, like from your first statement, the ECOWAS has become ineffective because you could clearly see that it is highly politicized. And you see the political economy of the sanctions and, you know, what has motivated the lifting of the sanctions. But how can we, you've mentioned some of the things that can happen, rule of law, strengthening of institutions. But if you elaborate on that, how can it become more effective instrument? Because again, I wanted to link it up to historically, to the 90s. I know you might have been involved in it during ECOMOC time in Liberia, in Sierra Leone. How do you compare those times, ECOWAS of those times, to ECOWAS of now? What has changed? Is there any significant change?
ECOWAS of the past, again, I make this statement, and I want to place a caveat that I am not a protagonist of military rule. But what was at that time that ECOWAS was created, we had a preponderance of military leaders across the ECOWAS. It is they are either military leaders, or even if they are civilian leaders in a democracy, they are leaders with military experience. So the cost of governance, the kind of argumentation that goes for decisions to be made were very, very simple and very direct. They are not prolonged over time, and you don't have views and conflicts over decisions that are made. General Babangida took by a phone call, spoke to the chief of army staff and his service chiefs and said, deploy to Liberia. And we were able to deploy in Liberia. That was happening while efforts are made to build a coalition of other states to come together. And that was done. Ghana joined up, Guinea joined up, and gradually some other nations came up. Just like Sierra Leone, Abacha's coursemate, General Momo his regime was upset, and General Abacha, all he needed to do was a phone call, and we were able to deploy. But with democracy, it is a different, slow system where there is a lot of argumentation, where even within the young democracies, there are conflicts by which the nations are finding the learning process of democracy to have themselves stabilized. So if you look at the history, about the spectrum, through the spectrum of history, we have an age of innocence in which ECOWAS was actually founded to serve a socio-economic purpose. That was basically what ECOWAS was founded to serve, to ensure that there was free movement of goods and services, and that we are able to share our common productivity, and also to enjoy our pre-colonial ethno-linguistic affinities. That was why the foremost principle is free movement of
people,
goods, services, and people. And another controversial one, which wasn't in those days, but suddenly has become over the past 7 years, the ECOWAS transhumans policy, which is also to guarantee the sanctity of the centuries-old movement of herders, including fishermen, across the West African space. That was the original founding purpose. But since the collapse of the bipolar world and the emergence of the unipolar world, the idea and democracy, the idea of nations, the idea of nations fighting each other was obviated, and internal conflicts, we started to face
a prevalence
of internal conflicts. And ECOWAS had to address itself to deal with this. And that was how the ECOMOG model came. The ECOMOG, for its success, was copied as the Africa Union standby force, for which each region was supposed to have a standby brigade. But the question of funding and question of sovereignties has been a huge a detraction for the establishment of this military purpose. Yet, the sub-region, and including the AU, has been able to set up also very, 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 very commendable multilateral organizations, like the ECOWAS Bank, like the Custom Union, and so many others that we have. So one cannot, by just one statement, either say ECOWAS is at its best that can be, or to condemn ECOWAS. But like any political organism, it's a thing that will develop over time. We were alive when the UK withdrew
from EU,
from the Union. We are alive when a Schengen visa cannot get you into the UK because they are not in the Schengen Union. We have seen how the euro is not even used in Switzerland and so many other and one or two other countries. So this is all politics of various states in defending their own interests. But what is consistent is, as much as ECOWAS is shaky, because within it now you have the Mano River Union, you have the Accra Initiative, Lake Chad Basin MNGTF, and then the grand impact, you have the Sahelian states, for which France's Operation Barkhane was not able to help them to deal with their problems over the past 20 years, in spite of the G5 Sahel that they were able to establish. But now that they've decided to take their destiny in their hands and to find appropriate foreign partners who will fill that technological gap that they require to deal with their existential threats. So I don't know if, again, another long conversation has not addressed your question or has thrown up new interesting issues.
No. It has. And I think we're coming to the last. We're coming to the last question.
Thank you.
And what you said. I think I'll wrap up with this last question, but I'll just summarize what you said, and that mirrors my own research in what I've been doing, because I've been writing on several books looking at democracy. And in my last book, when I was looking at Nigeria's fourth republic in militarized democracy, I was arguing, and I've been arguing as well, that Africans or Nigerians should start looking at our own form of democracy. And I'm, from what you've mentioned here, looking at the transhumanist political stuff and looking at how, like Riley said, you mentioned that if your house is on fire, you're not looking at the quality, you're looking at how. So all of that mirrors that Africa countries or ECOWAS needs to find their own solutions. And that comes into the system as well. We've looked at how elections also breed in these places. One of the reasons I think ECOWAS have been ineffective is the contradictions or paradoxes in ECOWAS itself. In terms of, does it support, what kind of government does it support? Authoritarian governments, or does it support democracy or military coups? And then again, we look at issues of sovereignty, like you mentioned, where it says a non-intervention in each country, and also the person that's going to intervene as well, Niger can easily point to there's election rigging in Nigeria and say, what moral right do you have? So if we look at all of this stuff and look at this, the, you know, sub-alliances that are forming in all of these places, do you think African, also looking at AU, looking at Africa 2063 and African solutions for African solutions, are all of these things just mantra? Or should we really, really be looking at our own solutions? Should Africa, should ECOWAS, should Nigeria be looking at, sit down and look at a solution or a system that works for it and develop that system? If yes, what would it look like? I wanted to finish on this note and also point that to how ECOWAS can address the issue with Niger, Burkina Faso, and if you just take a broad sweeping overview as to round up the whole podcast.
Thank you in this Viva, in this PhD Viva, that you are asking me in 2 minutes to capture the whole of my chapter one.
I'm sure you are capable, sir.
Well, one reality is what is consistent is interest, and interest is not one tangible substance that you can hold, and that sword that your grandfather bequeathed to you remains a sword in its constituents and composition and nature that you will also hand over to your children and they hand over to their grandchildren. Interests really are dynamic, and so are these organisms we call nations and their leaders. So, but What is inherent as a one point I agree with the West that pushes democracy is that democracy is inherent in human nature. And conflict indeed is inherent in human nature because you conflict even within yourself and you debate around it. But what is good that we, the elites who are educated, knowledgeable, and informed, is that we must always come to a consensus on matters. And they should be civilized and civil consensus, not belligerence. Okay? And that we really will need to share a common destiny. And if our internal and international politics can be played in this disposition, would be the better for us. And this is actually the origin of the mantra of Africa solutions for Africa problems. But the preponderance of the challenges that we have in Africa is firstly corruption and exclusion. And with these two problems that we have, which are mostly elite driven, I don't want to sound spiritual, but then if we do not take the conscience vote to redress and redeem ourselves from these maladies, every other sector of development that would put Africa in a prime position for it to be able to deal with its own problems by its own self will rather be an illusion. We are technologically challenged. We are industrially challenged. We are monetarily challenged. We are politically challenged. With all the resources we have, there is hardly an African nation that builds any resource it has to the second value. Take Nigeria, for example. Even crude oil. Even crude oil that we consume in quantums. We have the crude oil, we can't refine it. Not to talk about more interesting things like lithium. Not even basic things as cashew. Not cocoa. Not sesame. We cannot even upgrade that to the second value. Because elites understand how easier it is to ship out a ton of uranium of an international value of $200, but ship it out for 2 cents, for God's sake. For God's sake. So unless we are able to understand how in our individual nations these kinds of things are going on, and we empathize with otherwise those who are committed to change, you can't have a nation who is about the fourth or fifth world leader in bauxite, but imports aluminium roofing sheets. You can't have a nation that is rated the third or the fifth in uranium, but doesn't have one reactor, and only its state capital is guaranteed 6 hours power in electricity in a year. Yet, you give the people the beautiful illusion of democracy and all the fine principles that follow it. unless we are able to deal with that, Dr. Nwankwa. Peace and development will continue to elude us in Africa. I hope I've been able to dodge your question.
you have, General. You've really been your views have really been insightful, thought provoking, and I would say there's nothing I don't agree with, and I hardly will agree. I do agree with virtually everything you've said, and we're really indeed very grateful to have you this morning to join us. And we look forward to call you again for a lecture, because this deserves a lecture. And I already have the topic. You mentioned something. You made a statement. It was a categorical statement. You said, I wrote it somewhere. You said Nigeria will never have a coup. Will never happen in Nigeria. So I want to say that lecture is going to be, because I've been asked this question recently in my travel to France, and a lot of people see, is Nigeria coup proof? So I think that's going to be the lecture you're going to deliver. Well, I'll be in touch soon and see if your predictions or assumptions or presumptions are correct. But until then, sir, thank you very much for appearing, and we look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nwankwa. I hold this privilege very, very highly. And I am most grateful and humbled by the invitation and the opportunity to speak. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir. Have a great day. Oh, thank you, viewers and listeners. We're indeed very blessed to have General Salah Bala join us this morning to discuss the coup and the political development in the ECOWAS region. I hope you've learned a lot from these conversations, and I implore you to stay tuned to our next episode. Bye for now. And also, do not forget to subscribe to our channel.